the red, red robin comes bopping along, along. There'll be no more sobbing when he starts throbbing that old sweet song. Wake up, you sleepyhead. Get up, get up, get out of bed. Cheer up, the sun is red. Live, love, laugh and be happy.
Independent, totally biased, Hull Kingston Rovers. You are listening to the Red Robin podcast with Joe Appleyard and Chris Johnson. Hello and welcome to the fourth Red Robin podcast and the first of Heritage Casts. It's great to be back talking rugby league, Joe, especially as the last time we spoke was when we interviewed the mercurial Scotty Morrell.
Yeah, it was an absolute brilliant interview, much different to the first one we did with Dobbo, wasn't it? It's nice to have a catch-up. We spoke before we come on air, and I think just the response that we got on social media, you know, some of the stuff that Scott said, just absolutely fantastic. And you could even the way he started welling up when he was talking about when he left the club in 2012, what a brilliant bloke and just a great ambassador for rugby league. And we spoke about what he's done, especially in Championship rugby, and now he's going to play his trade at Keighley in 2021. And hopefully we see him back in the red and white one day, hopefully in the coaching staff. There was definitely hinting of it on social media, wasn't there? But brilliant to have him and people like Jason Neverton and all of his friends from Halifax and stuff get involved with the social media stuff that we do on Red Robin Podcast.
Yeah, he's definitely a cheeky chap and he loves the banter, doesn't he? But he was an absolute gentleman and he couldn't have been more helpful. For me, it epitomises everything that a supporter wants to see in a player who represents our club. You know, he was enthusiastic, he was passionate. Importantly, he was respectful and he really brought home what it means to represent the red and whites. And don't forget, he could not stand that lot from across the river.
And I think that's just proves, you know, I think a great thing that he mentioned was he came over, you know, as a West Yorkshire lad from Leeds and ended up leaving like he was part of East Hull. And obviously it was such a shame that, especially in the first bit, his Wi-Fi was a bit dodgy on it, so we cut out a few times. And what people don't realise is we actually filmed it about four times. It was a bit on and off on it, but it was absolutely brilliant. Just a great bloke on and off the field, mate. And it was a pleasure to have him on and I wish him all the best for his season at Keighley.
Yeah, and that takes us to the here and now, Joe. And we saw in League Express that Paul Lakin had done another interview. We spoke about his appointment in the very first podcast that we did, and he's reiterated that he's got two strategic priorities to deliver whilst he's at the club. Obviously, number one, he's purchasing Craven Park and the land around the stadium from Hull City Council. And the second priority is to bring external investment into the club with a view to Neil Hudgell retaining a minority stake in the club. So again, you know, it's good that we've got some clear purpose and real vision for the club going forward.
We said it in the first podcast, I believe he's the right man for the job and everything he's doing just screams what Hull Kingston Rovers need, the right vision. And if that's from our sponsors, obviously it's announced that Sporting Pay is going to be on our home shirt and Tile Mountain is going to be on our away shirt, which is massive. And people don't realise, you know, Sporting Pay, the work with over 80 professional clubs, Rangers, Hibs, Middlesex Cricket. And I think that's what Paul's bringing, obviously, because of his Premier League background. These big sponsors, it might not mean much, but it's the biggest sponsorship deal in about a decade, I think, if I read correctly. And that could lead to signing an Aussie next year. You know, it's all about that recruitment and building the stadium and buying the stadium and building stuff around it. That's what we need to do to take us to the next level. And it's all right, building obviously what we've done on Craven Park at the moment. But if we can buy that stadium that Paul wants, and obviously if we can get investors, that could be from all around the world, hopefully. And Neil's going to take a minority stake that you mentioned, Chris. It's really positive stuff at the minute, isn't it? And, you know, it's really going well off the field. And I can't wait for 5-6 weeks' time when we can start hopefully being positive on the field, because it's all right getting all this, you know, all these vibes going that we're going to buy the stadium, we're going to get loads of investors, we've got really good sponsors, but ultimately you've got to do it on the pitch because that's where the money will come from, finishing in the playoffs and getting a good spot in the Challenge Cup, which I think the draw is in a few days, isn't it? I know we're not in it, but rounds one and two are getting drawn and I'm looking forward to the season to start now, mate. There's not much to look forward to, like we mentioned, but there's no point dwelling on it. You know, we are where we are with lockdown and all that rubbish, but Rugby league's coming back soon, mate, and I can't wait for it to be on. And hopefully, all the games will be shown on Sky or wherever they may be on the Our League app as well.
Yeah, and I think obviously Paul, the appointment, he's starting to maybe open a few doors that were maybe previously closed to the club, and he's looking at new ways of bringing investment into the side. And you know, the shirt sponsorship deals are really big news. And I think I've seen a few fans on Twitter saying about, well, I've got my shirt and it doesn't have a sponsor. But the club are offering to put the sponsors on the shirt. So I think there's some news coming out from the club in the future about how fans can get that sorted.
Yeah, they are. And I think, obviously, income and revenue off the kits is massive. And with Christmas coming up, the club had to release the kits. You know, it's rightly so that they did it in December. And what we've probably done over the past few years is we've jumped at the chance of getting maybe a local business. And that's no disrespect to the drink company or anyone who sponsors the Robins. But Paul said, look, we're taking our time. The right sponsors haven't come to us yet. And that's fair enough, isn't it? You know, I'm sure once this lockdown's over, fans can just go and get the sponsors on. So I definitely don't know why they're complaining, because there's a lot of money going to get pumped into all Kingston Rovers. And I think what I like from Sporting Pay, which is going to be on the home shirt, mate, is they mentioned that they're really big on technology, and they've got really good experience in the sports industry, and it's going to assist our match day and event operations, which is huge as well. We want to make a professional environment, don't we, on and off the field. And Paul Lakin's doing a great job at the moment, and I can't wait once the season starts. Hopefully he can reap them rewards, because he's put a lot of graft in, and he definitely knows the club inside out, and he wants the best for all Kingston Rovers. And we've kind of gone away from that. We've kind of just ticked boxes over the past few years, and he's come in and gone, do you know what? You know, we're in a bit of a rubbish situation here. We've got to have a full clear out, and everything's got to change. And if that's changing certain stuff, then so be it. You know, we're all about traditions, but at the end of the day, income's the most important thing in professional sports. And like I mentioned, if we get a really good sponsor, it can give us a few hundred grand, and that can go towards an Australian's, you know, salary for the next 2 or 3 years if we're building for the future, like they already are, Tony Smith, Danny Maguire and Paul Lakin.
Yeah, and on that Sporting Pay sponsorship announcement, it was interesting to read that the club are planning on a cashless Craven Park next season. So exciting times on and off the pitch. But obviously we'll move on to stuff that is happening on the pitch. And the great news that obviously Brad Takarangi and Albert Vette are landing in the UK this week. We saw on Twitter that Brad's already landed to a snowy East Hull. But we also saw during the week some questions raised about who will be captaining the side next season. I think we had Brad, Albert, Sean Kenny-Dowell, Ryan Hall, Corbin Sims, all mentioned in the Hull Daily Mail by James O'Brien. And we actually did a Twitter poll to see what people's opinions was on who might be captain. We got nearly 100 votes. And Corbin Sims was way out in front, polling 59% of the votes. Interestingly, Cade Lynette was omitted from the article, what James O'Brien did in the Hull Daily Mail. Where do you see the captaincy going next season, Joe?
It's a real tough one, isn't it, mate? I mean, obviously for experience and you know, everything they've done in the game, you know, it screams Corbin Sims. I think if he's anything like his brother, Ashton and Tarek, they're just very vocal, aren't they? But I'd like to see it maybe to a local lad. I think maybe, this may be me being biased, but I think if you're looking for the long term, George is in with a shout. I mean, it's up to him if he'd want to be captain, especially, you know, controlling a pack at his age. But he's the longest serving player at the club, and I can't really see George going anywhere. You know, I think he's going to play the rest of his career, hopefully, at Craven Park. Or maybe a Dean Adley coming in there. Obviously, he's been there and done that with Hull FC. He plays 80 minutes regularly, but I could see it maybe going. I hope they don't do a dual one like they did. Obviously, they've done with Mossy and Weller, didn't they, last year before the tragedy happened at Wakefield for Mossy. But I think it needs to be one person. I'm going to say either Corbin Sims, you know, Kenny Dowell, but I think it's got to be someone in the middle of the park. Matt Parcell could be in with a shout. We don't see what happens at training. You know, you might see someone who's really shy, looks like he's shy on social media and don't really get involved with the off-field incident, but on the pitch, you know, don't shut up. And whoever Tony, Danny, Stanley, David, whoever they're Audrey, whoever they choose, is definitely going to be the right man for the job. But off the cuff, I think it is going to be Corbin Sims, but I'd like to see George or Dean Adley. What about you?
Yeah, I'm probably a little bit like what Tony Smith said. He's got an open mind at the moment, hasn't he? And he's waiting to welcome Brad and Albert into training. to see how they adapt and how they get the lads going. So at the moment, you know, I like a local lad to be leading the side. I think, you know, they play a huge role in integrating the players from overseas into the side. So it'd be great to have a local lad involved, whether it's vice captain or club captain. At the moment, I'd probably go with a Twitter poll and say Corbin Sims. But, you know, Tony's not afraid to throw a curveball out there, is he? So I'm sure the announcement will be eagerly anticipated by Rover supporters. Excitedly, we've got the news that Rovers are planning a pre-season friendly against Castleford on March the 14th. So we're actually starting to talk about games coming up. It's not that far away. So it's something that's definitely got me excited. And it'll be 364 days since we last played at Craven Park. So almost a full year. I think they also mentioned that the game's going to be used, obviously not just for on-the-pitch requirements, but it'll be about the biosecurity measures and they're looking at how Craven Park adapts to COVID security, etc. With a view to playing games then, because obviously the season's going to be played behind closed doors, especially at the start of the season. So it'd be interesting to see how we adapt to that challenge.
It will be, mate. And obviously we're the only club last season who didn't end up playing an home game post-national lockdown number one. So yeah, you mentioned nearly a year since that League Challenge Cup game. It'll be great just to see the lads back. And I'm hoping maybe Cass and Rovers can do something where they put it on a YouTube page or it's on the Our League app or something like that, because it'd be great, even though it's a friendly, we're not going to be able to go, are we? So it'd be good, especially for us who are doing this podcast. We want to see every game so we can talk about it and we want to know what we're on about. We don't just want to be reading in the 63rd minute that someone did a good pass. You know, we want to see it in, you know, on telly. So hopefully the lads can work out that. But it'll be great to have, just see Rovers again, won't it, mate? You know, I've definitely missed it these past few months and everyone's going to be rusty. I think everyone will get a shout. Probably Brad Takarangi and Albert Vetti. It'll be massive for them. They're flying over, aren't they, at the minute? Brad's here now. So everyone will be rusty, but everyone's in the same boat. I think everyone's only going to be playing one friendly. But the amount of work they do, you know, on the training pitch, and they'll be doing games against each other, it won't take as long to catch up to speed with everybody else, mate. So hopefully, and it was really good to see when we put the tweet out that obviously James O'Brien put that it was going to be announced soon about the friendly. We put Danny Maguire, that drop goal in 2019. Little stuff like that, mate. Him quoting it, saying good times. Add 120 retweets and likes. Give us another 30, 40 followers, mate. So it's really good that legends of the game are getting involved. We've had Sean Kenny Dowell, like our stuff, Brad Takarangi. So it's great that the players and the coaching staff are taking us serious as well, because obviously we're not affiliated with a club and we state that, you know, obviously it's mine and Chris's views, but you know, we want them to respect us as we respect them, mate. It just bodes well for the future.
Yeah, and I'm a bit like you, Joe. I'm desperate to see some rugby league. You know, on paper we look fantastic, don't we? The signings we've made, the direction the club's heading in terms of Craven Park investment, etc. But really, as supporters, what we want to be doing is watching the games. We want to be stood on the terrace. We want to be stood with our friends and family. So, like you said, I hope that the club are able to bring that game to us on, you know, whether it's through OKR TV or whether it's on Facebook, because the demand's there. People are desperate to see these players get a run out in the red and white shirts. And obviously with the season starting at the end of March, we want to see some of these players on the pitch now. One player who might not feature is Jordan Abdul. He suffered a setback after tearing a quad muscle in training, and he's already missed the start of pre-season after undergoing knee surgery. Hopefully it's not a major setback. They said it's a tweak of an old injury. But obviously with Jordan Abdul going in as our, you know, probably number one halfback, he's not someone we want to see on the sidelines.
No, you don't want to see anyone, do you, mate? You know, it was bad when the news came out, but I hope for Jordan and for our sakes, it's not the end of the world and it's not going to turn into something serious. Yeah, you mentioned Tony said it's just a few weeks. He might get 30, 20 minutes in that friendly, but we don't want to rush him back, especially as an halfback. You know, he'll get back up to speed, and I don't think it's as serious as it's meant out to be, and I really hope not. But we're going to get injuries. It's always been the old Kingston Rovers way, and we have to adapt. But that talking point again, if Abdul goes, you've got Mikey, you've got Rowan Milnes or Joe Key's going to have to come in very inexperienced. And I don't want to be negative, but you know, I'm hoping we don't miss Jordan because he's my number one halfback. He needs to be in that starting six or seven every week because without him, we're going to be a much weaker team. It's a massive season for a lot of players. Massive for Jordan Abdul. He's taking over now as that number one halfback. So it's time for him to take his stand and get that consistency back, because that game against Wigan last season, you know, unplayable, just played Wigan off the park. And then some games he touches the ball about three times. So it's a new season. Yep, little niggle injury, but we move on and hopefully we see Jordan Abdul in that friendly. And obviously we go back a little bit to the past, mate. Our next heritage, probably the most anticipated of our heritage cast, and the response on social media for this great guy, that is Clint Ewer, mate. We're going to get Clint on in the next 5 minutes or so. Do you know what? I just think the bloke was absolutely quality. It was just what he did off the pitch. He just loved Eastall, didn't he? And really good times when you get him and Bengalier and stuff like that. It was just absolutely fantastic. And I think he's going to have some good stories, mate.
Yeah, and just like Michael Dobson and obviously Scott Morello, our last guest, you know, they weren't just good players, they were good people. And Clint's another one who's admitted that, you know, his 4 years wearing the red and white of all Kingston Rovers were the best years of his career. And it's important that, you know, when we get these people on, we give them the respect that they deserve, because, like you said, I'm massively excited about getting Clint on. I remember stood on the East End terrace watching him, and he was a player who made you excited. He was someone who you wanted to go watch at Old Kingston Rovers. And for us to get him on as a guest and him to be so up for it as well, you know, we only had to ask him once, and his response was amazing, wasn't it? He couldn't wait to come over and get on board and help us out.
Yeah, when he sent that voice note, I was at work at the time, and you know, I do admit I got a little bit giddy. It's probably the biggest one we've had so far, and I think he's a fan's favourite for a reason. And you look what he's doing now, mate, chief exec for the Aussie Rugby League Association. He respects every player, doesn't he? And he realises that people, especially in poor communities, when he came over to Eastall, there's a lot of unemployment in the city, isn't there? And he realised that rugby league's their life, and the amount of work he did off the pitch for Kingston Rovers, you know, he was trying to get equal pay. Just so much we're going to speak to him about, and just seems a really nice bloke, mate, and I'm looking forward to getting him on and, you know, chatting to him. I think it's going to be a little bit different tone from Scotty's, probably a bit different from Dobbo's as well, but that's the beauty of doing these podcasts, isn't it? It's we get a different mindset every week, and I know the fans are really looking forward to this, and fingers crossed the Wi-Fi's a little bit better in Sydney than it is in West Yorkshire.
Yeah, that'll be telling, won't it? I think what swayed it for, you know, for my love of Clint Newton was that when we signed him in 2000, obviously there was a few other Super League teams who were sort of sniffing around him at the time, but it was Justin Morgan's sort of vision and that he set out for the club, and the passion that he was told about of the fans, what swayed it for him to sign. And I think that's what really sold him to me, is that someone, he wanted here just to come over and take the money and run. He was actually wanting to invest his life and his time into the club. And you saw that in his performances.
You did, and like, you didn't miss a game in 2009 and 2010, played 80 minutes all the time. And it says something that obviously when he signed the deal, and we'll talk about this, you know, Phil Gus Gould, who was a massive name in the NRL, you know, he got Clint back a year early, which was a shame for us, but he knew how influential he was on and off the field, and just to make the dream team in 2009. And let's not forget, when he joined Rovers in 2008, he'd won the grand final the year before, mate. And I'm going to speak to him because obviously when we're doing a bit of research, I didn't know when the one that Melbourne won the grand final in 2007, about 2 or 3 years later, they actually got it scrapped because they broke salary cap. And looking at the team, I'm not surprised because they had like Billy Slater, Cameron Smith, Greg Inglis. They had a brilliant team, you know, Clint included. So, you know, we'll get him on in a few minutes. And I think this is going to be a really good one, mate. I can't wait to get Clint Newton on the Red Robin podcast.
Well, there you go. Stay tuned as we bring you Clint Newton.
They live and breathe footy here, and you know, especially now more than ever in England, where they're going through, you know, the economy so-called crisis, I suppose that the people of East Hull still, you know, put their hands in their pockets and come and watch the game they love. You know, some of the people, this is what they live for every week. and you know, they go to work with either a dirty frown on their face or, you know, a big smile, and that's, you know, it's good to have that sort of pressure on you, but, you know, it's also fantastic to, you know, play for such a great group of people.
In podcast part two, unfortunately we've had a few difficulties, and it's not Scott Morrell's Wi-Fi like it was last week, it's Chris's, so unfortunately for you guys who don't like the sound of my voice, it's just going to be me, Joe Appleyard, and special guest Clint Newton for this Heritage episode. So thanks for doing this, Clint. Obviously we've struggled a bit, haven't we, these first 5 minutes, but thank you for doing this, mate, we really appreciate it. How's lockdown for you at the minute, because we're in a national lockdown, you know, it's -4, it's a bit doom and gloom, but rugby's starting soon, and that's the same for you guys over in the NRL. How's it been these last few months?
Yeah, I mean, obviously one of the first things I want to say is that, you know, I really am sending my warmest regards to everyone in England. You know, given the fact of what you're going through right now, I've got family members over there. My wife has got her grandmother and father that live there, plus a lot of our friends and a lot of my ex-teammates. So it is actually really difficult to watch, and really difficult to watch a country that is you know, considered a really vibrant and vibrant and strong and resilient country, you know, be sort of put in a position that you're currently in. So just want to wish everyone, you know, all the very best, and please, you know, stay safe. But yeah, with regards to Australia, I mean, we haven't dealt with, you know, anything like what, you know, like what some of the other countries have had to deal with. So again, it's been challenging. But at the same time, we're also acutely aware of what everyone else is dealing with around the world. So we've certainly considered ourselves pretty lucky, and we're really grateful that we're, you know, that we're on Treasure Island.
Yeah, it's great. Obviously, we're quite jealous, especially even the Isle of Man, which is only a few miles away from the English coast. They're all in the pubs now and having the nightlife. You know, restrictions have dropped. And at the minute, it's tough for people over here. And I think sport definitely unites us, and you'll know that more than anyone, and especially the Rovers fans. We're only 6 weeks away until the season starts. I think we've got a pre-season match on the 15th of March, which we're looking forward to. But apart from that, there's not much, you know, positivity at the minute. And this is why we really enjoy doing these podcasts. And it's such a shame that Chris's Wi-Fi has dropped, and it's just going to be me and you, because I know he loves it as well. But what we're just going to do, mate, just talk about your career, especially your time at the Red and Whites, and, you know, just have a catch-up, because you was definitely a fan's favourite when you was here in East Hull, and, you know, we really, really appreciated what you did for the club. So we'll take it back. Obviously, we know that you was born in America, and how was growing up, because obviously your dad, and I think was it your brother as well, professional golfer. So, you know, you come from a big golfing background. How was growing up in America at the time with, obviously, you know, your dad touring? Was it a really good experience?
Yeah, well, my father would tour, you know, all parts of the world. But I mean, when I was born, he was, you know, in the process of touring the US. So he'd usually base himself in the US, Australia, and London, because my mother's English. You know, she's from Dulwich, in London. So they would travel between those three countries whilst touring. But when I didn't really experience a whole lot of it, you know, given the fact that my father had his accident when I was two, and obviously was unable to continue playing, you know, on the professional tour. So, but again, you know, I've had the, you know, the great opportunity to do some travel with my family when Dad was commentating, and obviously, you know, being a professional rugby league player gave me lots of opportunities to go and travel and see the world, and it provided me no better opportunity than to play in the Super League for the Red and White.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, when you move back to Australia, rugby league is the national sport, and it's such big. When you was going through the ranks, starting at Newcastle, let's just take it back, 2001, seems a long time ago now, but you made your NRL debut against New Zealand. Was that just a dream come true?
Yeah, it was. I'd probably put that down as my single, you know, greatest achievement, just because of the fact of where I'd come from. If you had have asked me and any of my friends, and probably even family members, probably outside of my mum, my dad was a harsh but fair man, you know, throughout my career, but he always supported me and would back me continuously. But if someone had said at the age of 12 or 13, because I didn't start playing rugby league till I was 12, turning 13, you know, would I play even just one game of first grade? Then I would have been probably 2 million to 1 and blowing at that point. So again, just to know what I'd put myself through, you know, to get in a position to play just one game, that's definitely, you know, my greatest ever achievement. And then from there, obviously I had, you know, some good success throughout my career, but just getting to that position where I was able to play in front of my home crowd, in front of my family, in front of my friends, with largely a lot of my idols, like your Andrew Johns and Ben Kennedy and Adam McDougall and, you know, Danny Badiris and those guys, was, you know, for me, a really great achievement.
Yeah, it was such a shame because when we was obviously doing digging up on your history and your career, you know, Newcastle went to the grand final that season and won, didn't you? But obviously you picked up an injury a few weeks before. How was it, even though you saw obviously your teammates lifting that NRL trophy, was it devastating just to be on the sideline in that grand final? Because I can imagine how it feels, Clint.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that was difficult at a young age to work through, given the fact that I'd worked so hard, you know, to get into first grade, and then, you know, sort of go up and down, you know, through reserve grade and first grade, you know, which was Michael Hagan's strategy, was always to try and blood, you know, a good, strong core group of young players between the ages of sort of 19 and 22. And I just got myself back into first grade about a week before the semi-finals, and then badly broke my shoulder joint and my scapula, which, you know, put me out of action for a number of months. And so again, to miss out on the grand final was really difficult, but at the same time, it was such an outstanding moment in my career to be a part of a team that won the comp, you know, for Newcastle. And given the fact of what it meant to the community, you know, I certainly am truly grateful to be a part of that. And also knowing the fact that Daniel Abraham sort of came in my spot when we actually played together in under 13s, 14s and 15s was just a really good way to have it
happen. Yeah, but at least it was a friend who, you know, took your place. And you mentioned, obviously, we know you didn't play in that grand final, but you did play in the 2002 World Club Challenge against Bradford Bulls, so it was your first chance to come over to English soil and experience the atmosphere. Do you remember much from that World Club Challenge? Obviously playing really good players like Robbie Hunter-Paul and Leslie Vanacola. Bradford were a formidable team back in the early 2000s, but to come over as a youngster playing in England for the first time, how was that in the World Club Challenge? Obviously a big stepping stone.
Yeah, it was really difficult, if I'm being honest. Ben Kennedy withdrew, and I think Adam McDougall, and but I think our mindset going over there probably wasn't exactly thinking about winning a title. I think we had quite a young squad participate in that match, and I think we spent the first 5 days drinking, to be honest. And then the match was on the Friday. I think, you know, some guys wrapped up on the Wednesday, you know, having a beer. So we didn't really go in with great preparation. I'm happy to say I sort of wrap things up on about Monday. But I mean, the difficulty was obviously with that, we were at the beginning of our season. We hadn't played any matches. The conditions in the lead up to the game were actually really good. You know, it was, we trained in really dry weather. And then just as it happens, you know, we play at Huddersfield, you know, in an absolutely flogged down, you know, that night where the rain was really going, you know, running parallel to the field. And it was just, you know, totally different conditions to what we'd one, trained in, two, experienced in Australia. And we just didn't go in with the right mentality. We used it as a really, you know, more of a team bonding, you know, tour than, you know, trying to claim a trophy. It's one of the things that I, you know, probably do regret, you know, that we probably didn't take it as serious as what we should have. And I think, you know, off the kickoff, Matty Parsons dropped it and kind of set the scene for the rest of the night. But in true English refereeing, you know, conditions, I think, you know, we Bradford kicked a ball just before half time and it ricocheted off the referee's leg and went into the in goal, and they dived on it and he awarded the try, which kind of, you know, separated him out a bit. So, which much to the surprise of us. But yeah, I think we had a late comeback, but they were a really formidable team, Bradford. I remember watching the video session, and Joey was sitting next to me and we were watching Stuart Fielden and Jamie Peacock and Joe Vunganar and those guys wind up with some of our video edits. And I never forget, like, Joey sitting there and he was just, you know, sort of saying, holy shit, you know, like, look at these, look how big these guys are. And, you know, once your skipper and the guy that is saying that, I know for a 20-year-old, which I was, you sort of go, right, okay, we're up against it here. But they were a great team and they certainly deserved to win. But it was good to go over there and play. And it was my first game back from my broken scapula, so it was a nice initiation back into the season.
Yeah, once you've done that, you know, you can go back to the NRL and, you know, play freely. Because I think what, especially the Super League commentators think, in the World Club Challenges, because our season's already started and you guys are still just playing your trial matches or your pre-season matches, it is kind of just like a pre-season test for you, whoever the NRL team is. And there's recent talk of maybe that it's done its time, and with the travelling and obviously with COVID now, probably looking at the bigger picture, is it worth sending a team all the way over? But there is some pros and cons. But just before we move on, do you think it should stay the World Club Challenge?
Oh, I think it's definitely got a place. I just think it's just about where it sits. You know, I think that there's definitely some issues with having it at the beginning of the year for a number of different reasons, but largely because you're potentially not playing so previous year. And I think playing it at the beginning of the year loses where, again, you're starting a season, new squad. And last year's kind of done it. I think that certainly taking more, you know, half a dozen years, decade, but
can you hear us, Clint? You seem to have dropped out.
Yeah, have you got me?
Yeah, mate, perfect. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, we only dropped out for a few seconds.
So I think there's a place for it. I just think in my view, I think if there's a place, it's got to be at the end of the season. It's something that I do think both hemispheres need to align on with regards to when their seasons finish, because really what you'd like to have is both seasons kicking off on the same weekend and finishing up on the same weekend. And then you could potentially, you know, play it, you know, the week or, you know, 2 weeks after. But then it's just about where does international rugby league fit in there as well. So, again, I'd certainly think there's an opportunity, whether you look at some type of, you know, Northern and Southern Hemisphere World Series type, you know, thing where you've got your, you know, your first and second, or, you know, first, second, third, fourth playing. But again, it all comes down to the economic viability of the match and how it's going to be paid for and whether it's going to be engaging enough to continue.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think they tried that a few seasons ago, 2017, I believe. But it's just getting that time, and especially with the World Cup coming up as well. So you ended up playing 100 games for Newcastle, and then in 2007 you made that move to the Melbourne Storm. What was, you know, how come you moved to Melbourne? Was it just the right time to move on? And it ended up going really well, because you ended up winning a grand final, playing in a grand final in 2007, and actually scoring in the 34-8 victory over Manly Sea Eagles.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we had a change of coach, you know, after the 2006 season, where we'd had some success, but, you know, we probably underperformed in the finals. They had a change of coach with Brian Smith coming in and replacing Michael Hagan. And again, it was just a really difficult, I found it really difficult, you know, working with Brian. And again, whether for whatever reason, we just didn't quite align with, you know, what I believed to be, you know, the right way to, you know, engage a team and demonstrate respect towards the playing group. And again, he had his views, and that's okay. And I've really, you know, come to understand that, you know, it is a business. And he had a job to do, and I wasn't a part of his plans. And, you know, again, as difficult as it was for me, you know, it turned out to be, you know, the best decision I made was to leave after, you know, he said that I wasn't a part of his plans for the remainder of the 2007 season, and that I'd be better off, you know, going to England. But it was just how it was done. That's what I was disappointed with, where there seemed to be a lot of conversations going on without me being included, particularly given the fact that I had a British passport. It seemed to be an attractive approach to, you know, sort of position me with English clubs. But again, I made a judgment call based on the fact that once, you know, a coach doesn't want you in his team for his reasons, and that's okay, then I can't play there. Because it'd be no different to a worker, you know, going into the office and the boss saying, you know, I don't want you to work in this business. You're not part of the team. I don't see, you know, the value that you can provide. Well, rugby league's, you know, a bloody tough sport, and I think that it's played best when you're a part of an environment where there's mutual respect and when you're playing in an environment that's, you know, that aligns with your values, which when I left Newcastle, I didn't have a club to go to. It wasn't until later that night when I was having a beer with Joey and Denny Badiris and Kurt Gidley, where I got a phone call from Craig Bellamy, and he said, did I want to come to Melbourne? And at that point, I just terminated my contract. I had no club to go to, and I think I signed on for Melbourne. I agreed to go to Melbourne. He said, we don't have much money. I think it was about 20,000, you know, that I got to go there. And I'd sort of torn up, you know, the best part of 100 plus, you know, from leaving Newcastle. But yeah, it wasn't about the money for me. It was about, you know, it was about my values and the principles and of the decision, and I made the right decision. And the one thing that Bellamy said to me, which sort of got me well and truly over the line outside of the team that was coming first at the time, and effectively we were only coming, I think we were in the top six. You know, he said that, you know, I want you to be a part of this squad, but it's not my decision, you know, because it's not my team. And he said it was the leadership group. And when I asked the leadership group, did they want you to be part of this team? They all said yes. And so that was from what I had been a part of to what I was going to. It was an instant yes for me. And I was on the plane 24 hours later, and 4 months later, we'd won a premiership.
Yeah, it's a brilliant story, obviously, dropping, you know, the best part of 80K, you know, to go and enjoy your rugby. And I think that's the most important, isn't it? Got to get on with your coach. But for your players to have that respect, a lot of people at the end of the year awards, when they win the players' player, they say they'd rather win that than the player of the year because it's off their friends and their teammates. And he certainly was in good company, you know, Billy Slater, Cameron Smith, Israel Folau, Greg Inglis, who's now at Warrington, obviously, and Dallas Johnson. As soon as you went to Melbourne, did you just know there's some class in this team and we've got a really good chance of winning the comp like you did 4 months later?
Yeah, I remember going into the club, and it was just the overall professional standards that that hit you in the face, you know, with regards to whether it was the introduction I got to all the staff members in front office from the then CEO Brian Waldron, to going down into the change rooms. And I think the first thing I saw was Israel Folau and Sammy Tagatisi having it out with boxing gloves on because they'd had some sort of dispute, and all the guys were in a circle, and they went for about 2 minutes as hard as they could at each other without headshots, and everyone was yahooing and carrying on. And it was just the overall energy that was in the place. You could feel it the moment you went in there. And for where I was mentally and emotionally, It breathed so much life into me, and it was, you know, again, straight away I thought, you know, this is something special here. And I really got a great taste of it. And I think again, it's one of those proud moments that you don't often think about, but until you until you find yourself in those quiet moments, you know, where you're actually really proud that you were a part of that team and part of that club, because they have continually owned the mental conversation with themselves over the last decade, which has made them, you know, the most successful club in, you know, really Australian sport. And it's something that, you know, I'm incredibly proud to have been a part of.
Yeah, it's great too. And, you know, you look now, that was, what, 13, 14 years ago. Melbourne are still on top, aren't they? You know, champions, absolutely brilliant side. And obviously, after the grand final, mate, due to salary cap reasons, you know, you was released from Melbourne. But that led you, to, you know, over the waters and heading to East Hill. Just tell us, before we speak about your time at the Red and Whites, which we're going to go into depth about, Clint, how did the move actually come about? Obviously, was Justin a massive part of it? Was the other clubs interested? How did that move to Hull Kingston Rovers happen?
Yeah, I mean, we started the conversation, you know, really mid-season because, you know, as I said, you know, I got sort of wind of the fact that that there were conversations being had about me going to England, you know. So, you know, so there were a few clubs in England that had contacted me and said, are you aware that, you know, you're getting shopped around? And so obviously I wasn't, which then led me to the conversation with Brian, which ultimately led me to my decision that, you know, that I needed to depart Newcastle following him saying that, you know, I was no longer required for the rest of the season. So, so I really sort of stayed in contact with those clubs, you know, for the ensuing few months. And I did say to, you know, Craig Bellamy in about July, August, that if they weren't going to have the capacity to sign me, I couldn't play for another NRL club. I couldn't play for my third club in the best part of, you know, 12 months. And I would choose to go to England. And I had, you know, a number of clubs that were knocking on the door that that were interested in signing me for 2008. But I just thought on principle, and what was best for me was to not go potentially to another NRL club. And, you know, it was my sort of way of repaying, you know, Craig, was to, you know, to demonstrate to him that I won't play against Melbourne, you know, in the next, you know, couple of years, and I would go to England. So it was really right up until the 11th hour that I was going to stay at Melbourne. Jeremy Smith was going to, you know, sign with the Dragons. And at the last minute, for whatever reason, Jeremy chose not to go to the Dragons. Coincidentally, he went the following year and ended up winning a premiership with the Dragons during his time there. But when he didn't go to the Dragons, that immediately triggered for me to go to England. And, you know, there were a few clubs that were chasing around. But I really saw Hull KR is a great opportunity. It was one of those things that, you know, quite often in my career, and even now, once I transitioned out of playing, you know, professional rugby league, I'd always had a habit of intentionally, you know, putting myself in places where I was going to be uncomfortable, you know, because I thought that was where, you know, that's where you really find out, you know, who you are. And And by that, that's whether it's having uncomfortable conversations with people, making uncomfortable decisions that, you know, sort of go against the grain sometimes. And as difficult as they may be, if it's just the right thing to do for you, that's what I wanted to do. The simple fact is that the conditions were not going to be perfect, you know, by going to Hull KR. And that excited me. You know, but that's the point when you endure those difficult moments, when you put yourself in those uncomfortable positions, you go to a club like Hull KR instead of going to a, you know, a St. Helens or a Wigan or a Leeds that, you know, that had interest. It was more about the fact that it wasn't about the economic return that I was getting for KR. It was about, I saw it as a real challenge on the back of playing for the best team in the world in Melbourne, that I could go and play a role for not only, you know, Hull KR, but for the people of East Hull and the people of Hull in general. I'd heard a lot about it. I did my research on it. I knew the players that had played there from Australia. And I saw it as an opportunity. And it really was, when I look back, I look back on it really fondly, and it was arguably the best 4 years of my playing career. And that's, and that sort of led me to a whole bunch of things that happened, obviously, at KR.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And obviously, when you came over, did you know any Rovers players? Obviously, Ben Galea signed that year and stuff like that. But the Aussies at the time, did they sway you to come to East Hull, or was it literally just that you mentioned that challenge? And I think that's what's why we've probably dropped down in the rankings since, you know, the likes of you, Dobbo, and all them lot have left, because these NRL players, you know, that challenge is a bit too much for them, and we can't sign these big names like yourself and Ben Galea, because we haven't been performing on the pitch. And hopefully now with the new signings, which we'll speak about at the back end of this podcast, Clint, we can get back up there to them days that we had with you a lot. But at the time, you'd say a big challenge, but especially some of the Australian boys help you along the way.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, I've got to say that I had a I really connected with Justin and Neil Hudgel. You know, they were really great in their cell. You know, to me, not that I required, it didn't require a whole lot of sell. I still often say to Neil that he got me bloody cheap for the 4 years that he had that I were there. But at the same time, I was really taken in by Neil's passion, and I was taken in by what Justin, you know, wanted to try and achieve. And when you're talking to Neil and you know a bit of his backstory, and you know that he's passionate about the club and he's doing it for the right reasons, it's certainly not for for commercial or economic returns, it's hard not to be drawn in. And I really like the fact that we'd signed Benny Galea. Mick Veller obviously had a big year the year before. They'd signed Chev Walker, which I was really excited about playing alongside Chev, where I'd said to Justin, you know, like, I'd really like to play alongside him. But I also had heard a lot about, you know, the players of 2007 that that really, you know, did such an outstanding job in, you know, keeping them in the Super League. And that was, you know, again, that was something that I was really keen to experience. And again, I think that I really enjoyed the opportunity to put myself, I suppose, between a bullet and a target. And that was, you know, trying to drive a bit of a wedge between, you know, even bigger wedge between East Hull and West Hull. You know, and really buy into what the town was about, which was working class. You know, you're there to do a job. It's not a holiday, and you need to deliver. And I think that was the big part about it for me, was that, you know, I think that, like anything, actions will always indicate priorities. And for me, it was about delivering, you know, yes, off the field with some of the commentary that I would make, but also, you know, ensuring that when the people of East Hull and the people that came to Craven Park, that they, when they're watching me play, I just hoped that they would know that I'm there to do my very best for them, and to try and do what the jersey said, and that was, you know, bring pride back to East Hull.
Yeah, they're brilliant words, mate. You know, it's really emotional listening, because it was such good times, you know, them early years in Super League. And the fans, once they listen to this podcast, once we pull it out later, are really going to love that you've said that. And, you know, you talk about the fans, they're the heartbeat of the community. And you made your debut for the Robins in 2008, actually at Headingley, a defeat by Leeds Rhinos, who were brilliant at the time. But the week later, you scored your first try for the club, 24-22 against St Helens. That atmosphere, that first game, obviously picking up a victory against a really good team in Saints, did you just knew you'd made the right decision from that moment when you went over and the fans just showed how much they meant to you?
No, I think it was before that, to be honest. I realised what I was getting into really not long, you know. My experience when I arrived in Hull was very unique, you know, to put it mildly, where I the club probably hadn't put themselves in a position where they were used to, you know, a whole lot of, NRL players coming over and, you know, like putting them up and making sure that, you know, things were in place. And I never forget that I got picked up and we went to Hull, and I got dropped off by Barney and he was such a great guy. I'm sure I'll get to that, but that was the other big part of the club and the people of Hull, was they just were so genuine. And I really found myself, like, you know, relating to them and really wanting to do everything I could, because you could see how much sport and the jersey and your performance on the weekend, forget the result, the performance on the weekend impacted how people behaved and felt and their mindset of their next week at work. But I got there and I got dropped off, and God bless him, Barney, like we sort of dropped our bags off, and I got inside, and Benny Galea was staying in the same complex. And it looked like a retirement home, you know, type setup. And I remember going in and I dropped the bags off. And I got, you know, the keys to the car, and I sort of drove around. I didn't know anyone in Hull. I hadn't been given anyone's number or anyone like that. I just knew Ben Galea and his wife Jules was heavily pregnant. So my first night there, I have no idea how to work the heating system. And there's no furniture, none in this place, not one bit of furniture. So there's some Weet-Bix, there's some milk. Sarah Smith, who was fantastic, you know, there, like, you know, she'd got that sort of stuff there, but there was no furniture, and I could not work the heating out. Now, luckily at that time, I had a good friend at Qantas that sort of sorted me out with some additional baggage that I was allowed to carry, and in those bags were, like, you know, some, you know, towels and extra clothes and winter gear and all that sort of stuff, because obviously the cost of additional kilos, you know, was significant. Well, I got a couple of bags over. Now, one of those bags had a couple of towels in them, and I remember, like, laying, like, you know, at night, which it felt like midnight, was probably 7 o'clock, you know, because of how dark it got there, which I'd never been to England in the middle of winter. And I arrived about 2 days before New Year's Eve. And so I'd just come from a hot summer. I'd spent the whole pre-season with Melbourne Storm, you know, to make sure that I was ready to go when I got to England. And it was freezing cold, like in this apartment in Beverley. And I had to put all these layers of clothes on me. And I rolled up, a jumper. I had that as a pillow. I had a beanie on. I had these towels draped across me. And I, you know, and obviously, but in the night, I was, you know, you're just uncomfortable. And every time I'd roll, like, the towels would drop off me, and I'd just start freezing. Now, I did this for about three nights in a row. And then eventually I just said to Benny and Jules Galea, like, can I just stay with you until I sort, you know, out what's going on here, you know, with a place. So anyway, they took me in for a good couple of months, and then I had to work through that whole process of finding another, you know, another place to go and live. And I just found it really challenging, and not what I expected, but what it did do was it really, you know, built a level of resilience in me to sort of say, right, you know, you're not here, you don't have your family, you don't know anyone, you need to get shit done, you know, you need to get on with it, you know, like, and stop thinking about, like, oh, well, maybe it'd be better if I went home and all that sort of stuff. Like, no, you're here now, like, you're here to get a job done. And I'll never forget, like, our very first training session. I'm living with Benny Galea and Jules, and we wake up and it's snowing, you know, right? It's like January 3 or something. And it's snowing. And Benny and I are sort of like, this is awesome. Like, it's snowing. Like, it's the first time I've seen snow in my life. And we're, you know, we sort of go outside and we're all, you know, smiling and whatnot. And we're like, oh, well, this would be good. We'll head off to training. We'll get there. And because of the snow, we'll, you know, spend time with the boys. Who knows? We might even go to the pub for all I know. I don't know. You know, so, but I remember we were driving to the, to training. And no one tells you about the black ice on the road and all that sort of stuff. And I remember I was driving and we've gone to turn and just on the corner, just like it's just all, you know, black ice. And I go straight through the turn, straight up onto this embankment, you know, in a car that the club had leased me. And me and Benny just sort of like looked at each other and went, you know, what the hell just happened then? And I was like, you could see me. I was trying to turn into the embankment, we reverse out, get to training, we go in, I look outside, I send a photo to my mum, you know, just saying, this is the conditions, blah, blah, blah. It's probably up to our calves in snow. And me and Benny Galea's got gloves on, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And we're all in the sheds and blokes are getting their boots on. And I'm going, we're not training in this, surely. You know, and everyone's getting their boots on and you're meeting guys for the first time. And Benny and I are just going, what? Like, and Justin Morgan comes in, or Billy Mallinson comes in and goes, like, you know, all right, lads, you know, get out there. It's time to warm up and whatnot. And Justin Morgan, like, looks at Benny Galea and he just goes, you know, get those gloves off, like, in not those in such nice terms. And get out on the field. And, you know, off we went. We did 2100s that day and did up downs. And I remember sending my mum a text after and I had to do one touch typing, you know, because my thumbs was frozen and my fingers were frozen from doing up and off the grounds. And I was like, what have I got myself in for? But, hey, it's, you know, I just, you know, at the end of the day, you just grow to love it.
Oh yeah, and that was just in a week, and I think especially Brad Takarangi and Albert Vetti, they flew over your cycling. And if I'm looking out the window now, you know, it's blowing a blizzard, it's snowing, it's -4, so it's very similar conditions. So I'm sure to send it to them guys, and it's a bit of inspiration. But I think them first few weeks probably set the tone then, and you talked about resilience, and you had some really good seasons with Ulke Aklin, and I think 2009. Just epitomised that you scored 15 tries. We got to a Challenge Cup quarter-final, the Super League semi-final, unfortunately losing those. But you actually got in the Super League dream team with, you know, Dobson, Ben Galea, your good friend, and Sean Briscoe. Was 2009, was definitely the most successful that Rovers have had, which is such a shame because we only got to a semi and a quarter. But that team, I really thought was going to kick on from then. It was such a shame that over the next few years, people dropped off. But especially them 2009, 2010, beating FC in the playoffs. Just absolute brilliant times. And with them 2 years, especially, you know, a very special time for you.
Yeah, they were. I mean, again, like you saw that, you know, just even with making continual progress in 2008, just what it meant, right? You know, to the people, you know, of East Hull, you know, to the past players, you know, to people like Colin Hutton and Phil Lowe and those guys that, you know, Roger Millwood. I had a really, you know, sort of like, you know, profound respect for those guys because my father was, you know, he loved his rugby league, but knew a lot of the English players because obviously, you know, Hull KR produced a lot of, and Hull FC, you know, produced a lot of English representatives. So I was told a lot of stories about different players that came out of there. But, yeah, I mean, you know, 2008 was good, and then I did my knee at the back end of the season. And then 2009, yeah, I mean, 2009, 2010, I genuinely thought that we were a great shot at winning the Challenge Cup in 2009, and I was devastated with how we lost in the Challenge Cup in 2009.
That was, sorry, Clint, that was the drop goal, wasn't it, Lee?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And we were in front with a few minutes to go, and we, you know, they managed to get back in front. And I genuinely thought that if we beat Warrington, we'll win it. I mean, that was really hard. We actually then went on and lost, I think, about four or five in a row after that in the regular season, which kind of like disrupted a bit of our run home. But yeah, I mean, it was a successful year. I mean, Dobbo came over. Him and I struck up a really good partnership on the right hand side, and you know, Briscoe played well. Foxy, you know, obviously played well, and Benny Galea played well. We had a good team, but we were an underrated side. We punched well above our weight, you know, given the fact that, you know, that really, I mean, if we're being brutally honest, you know, the level of fairness from an economic position in the Super League, you know, I would suggest is would tended to weight towards the big clubs. And I think that, you know, we've seen that, right? I think we've had four premiership, you know, winners in the last couple of decades. You know, so I think that that's certainly something that they need to look at. But we were punching well above our weight. And then in 2010, again, we gave it a really big shake. I never forget, actually, you know, I think it was 2009 where we led, where we were actually leading the competition table. And I remember we'd won on the Sunday, I think, and then they announced at the ground that we were leading the comp. And I just remember the reaction that the fans had to that. That was a demonstration, again, very clear demonstration of just how much that team and we as a group of individuals that had, you know, a collective purpose, what it meant. And I was just obviously, I truly wish we had have brought some silverware back to the town as a way of just saying thanks, you know, for hanging in there. And supporting a team that had been in really the second division for the last, you know, couple of decades, but yeah, I mean they were two really good years. We were probably just a couple of players, you know, off, you know, really, you know, winning silverware. Just the depth that we had, we just didn't quite have it there. But on our day, I mean, you know, we'd beat anyone, and I think that was something that I was proud of.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, some of the victories back in them, you know, them 2009, 2010 days, just absolutely unbelievable. You know, beating teams like Leeds, Wigan, off, like blowing them off the park, especially at Craven Park, it became like a fortress. But, you know, one game that definitely sticks to mind, and I know it's a very special game, you know, the Hull FC against Hull Kingston Rovers derby, and especially that playoff game back end of 2010, you mentioned you knew what it meant for the, you know, the full city of Hull. But have you ever experienced anything like, especially at the KC at Hull's ground? Because obviously we're massive Rovers fans, but I personally think the derby's better at Hull's ground because you get more people in and it's a football ground, so the atmosphere is a bit better. But for you, you've played in grand finals, you know, you've probably been to State of Origins and stuff. But is the Hull derby up there in atmosphere wise for you?
Yeah, I mean the derbies were, you know, was just so incredibly special. You know, it's something that I talk about regularly here in Australia, and there is no other rugby league rivalry, in my view, you know, like the Hull Derby. And I'm sure, you know, other teams, you know, would say that, you know, whether it's, you know, your Leeds and Bradford, or, you know, your Wigan and, you know, Warrington and St Helens and all those teams, I'm sure they'll, you know, they would, you know, say the same thing. But just in my view, from what I experienced, you kind of have to have lived experience to, you know, of it to truly actually understand, you know, the level of intensity around it. But I think that one of the thing was that, you know, I was also very much aware that when you achieve significant impact, and I will say it was significant because, you know, Hull FC had a monopoly on the market there in Hull for quite some time, and they were the big brother at that point. Now, they, you know, we were the you know, the beaten down team that had that were once a formidable machine that was able to win premierships and really do, you know, do special things. But I think that whenever you achieve significant impact, you never do it on your own. You need the support and you need the belief from your team, and that's what matters. And I think that having guys like your Scott Morells and your Ben Kakanes and those guys that that really sort of bought into it as well, and the Aussies did. You know, Benny Fisher was really passionate about that space. But I knew there was the rivalry there, and I'd done plenty of reading about it. And I always remember, you know, that I thought, well, you know, hey, let's go all in here. You know, I'm going to go all in on my abilities and my standards, and I'm going to put myself in a position where I'm going to be judged. And but I also knew that I had a really resilient team there as well. They just, you know, I think they just needed to advance their professional standards, you know, and really believe in themselves. Like, I think people of Hull, they don't give themselves enough credit. You know, they don't give themselves enough credit for just how tough they are, how resilient they are, their ability to keep showing up. And I took it really personally when people would talk down about Hull. And the people of Hull, and that's both West and East. You know, it was just that when I'm living there, you know, it's like, don't talk shit about the place where, you know, where I'm living. These people are soul to the earth people that will give you the shirt off their back, you know, in the middle of winter, if it meant that it was going to make you okay. And that meant something to me. And so I remember I just thought that I'm going to try and, you know, have a bit of fun with this. I remember I called out, FC in one of my first, you know, press releases saying that, you know, we're in town, you know, like we're going to be the best team, you know, in Hull. And I remember speaking to, I think it was Charlie Mullen at the time. He was like, well, do you understand that, you know, they've never finished above FC for, you know, the best part of a couple of decades. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, they didn't have they weren't playing against the team that we've got now. And so we will finish above them. And then I remember, you know, the criticism that I got where I was like, oh, here we go, loudmouth Aussie. He's shooting his mouth off and, you know, and whatnot. But I remember, what drove me to sort of like just love that and really immerse myself in it was just, I remember I went to Sainsbury's where I was living, you know, when I first got there in Beverley. I remember obviously, you know, Beverley would be considered, you know, like West Hull. So I remember like pushing my trolley through and there was a husband and wife and they were both wearing FC jerseys. And they were coming towards me, and I remember the wife said in not so friendly terms, said, you know, what the F and hell are you doing on our side of the town? Like, fuck off back to, you know, East Hull. And I remember just sitting there, and he was so staunch, like, as well with her. And I just remember, like, thinking in myself, like, how am I going to play this? And I was just like, right, okay. Yeah, listen here, you know, when I'm here shopping in Sainsbury's, you know, you shut your mouth and, you know, keep walking. If you got nothing nice to say, the moment I put on a red and white jersey, come at me. You know, and I remember they just sort of like, they copped it on the chin and it was kind of like that initiation of, right, this is what I'm dealing with. You know, where people are stopping you, and on a regular basis, it happened quite regularly. and really telling me what they thought of me, of our team, of our fans, of that sort of thing. But that all was part of the theatre. And I really love that, you know, and I thought that, right, okay, if this is what we're going to do, then why not? Why not get involved and why not make it personal? And as I've said quite, you know, publicly, there was nothing personal with FC fans or Hull FC. It was just that I, you know, they were supporting the wrong team in my view. And I proved them right. I proved myself right, you know, because every year yeah, we beat them. Every year, like we finished, if we didn't finish above them, we knocked them out of the finals. You know, so so therefore, you know, in my view, it was, you know, it was a good period.
Oh, it was, mate. And you mentioned, you know, we was always on top of them in the league and then beating them in the playoffs and was definitely a thorn in the side. And just before we speak about Postal Kingston Rovers and we come to the back end of your career, mate, I just got a question off a fan saying, how did it feel when you used to run out last at Craven Park and people would be shouting "Mean Machine," that chant "Mean Machine"? Did it put the, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it became obviously a bit of a you know obviously a tradition. It started like, you know, when people used to say, "Oh, do I do that just for that?" No, it actually started way back in my first ever game in Jersey Flegg for the Knights. I was, you know, 17. 18 was my first ever game for the Knights at Jersey Flegg level. And I ran out last. I came off the bench and I ended up scoring two tries that game. And then I started the next week and then I started every game for the rest of the season. We went right through and played, you know, the Bulldogs in the grand final. You know, so from then it became really, you know, a superstition, you know, of mine to run out last. And it just became like really, again, more theatre to the fact that not only was it super, you know, it was a superstition of mine to run out last, but it was, you know, part of the Craven Park experience, you know. And I would like to think, you know, the boys enjoyed it. Like they'd always turn around and have a smile on their face, like when it would happen. And I, you know, I loved it. You know, when you're playing in front of a group of people that you know, how you play today is going to have an impact on how they feel for the next 7 days or whenever we play against, then I'm going to do everything I can, as will our, you know, our teammates or my teammates, to make today a good day. Now, that didn't always happen, you know, but the intention was that, you know, that's what would happen. And so that was the thing, you know, that I loved about it. But yeah, I mean, they were special moments, you know, like it's an adrenaline hit, you know, it's a, you get a thirst for it, right? You know, that you can never find in any bottle, you know, or anything else that you know in life. It's just it just is.
Yeah, that's great, Clint. You know, it's just really good talking and reminiscing about them times. And obviously the dreaded news came for us Rovers fans that he was going to get released a year early, Phil Gus Gould. He'd asked you to go back to Penrith, you know, mentor a few rookies. And over the next few seasons, you played for Penrith 46 times. You represented USA in the World Cup. And then obviously you went back to Newcastle for your final few years as a pro. Just tell us about them past few years, obviously going back to play in Australia for Penrith, playing 46 games, massive achievement in 2 years, representing your country, your native country of the United States of America, and then going back to Newcastle for one final year before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the decision to leave KR, it was all based on, you know, family circumstances. And it was not about, you know, financial gain or benefit or anything like that. It was literally the fact that I was with my my now wife, and who have now had two amazing daughters, who I met in England whilst I was playing with Hull KR, which makes it even more special, you know, for going there. And it was about, you know, what did we want to do as a family? Like, you know, for me, it was about, you know, well, I need to go back to Australia to, you know, to start to think about life after football. And also about, you know, where we are, you know, with my family and my mum and dad and those types of things. And I did genuinely believe that, that I'd, like my father and mother have always sort of maintained with me, is that your impact should be about, you know, about not just about your legacy, but whether or not you left a place in a better position than when you found it. And I did believe that, you know, the team, and Justin included, had done that. And I thought it was just time that that I went back to Australia, and Phil, you know, bought me for a particular reason, and I thought that I was well placed to provide what Phil needed, particularly on the back of, you know, my experience at KR. And I learned a lot, like during that period, like a lot about leadership, a lot about having empathy and understanding for other, you know, team members. When I first turned up, I was very hard, and, you know, potentially too hard, you know, on certain people. But again, it was about really just going all in on my standards. And when I say my standards, I know that might sound, you know, in some ways very self-centered, but I just believed that the guys that I was playing with could do more, could do better, could be better versions of themselves. And I think that, collectively, we were able to achieve, you know, some great outcomes for guys. And so when I went back to Penrith, they were sort of going through the same thing, you know, where they had to make some, you know, tough decisions during that period. You know, Ivan was brought in to do a job, and Phil just said, you know, give me 2 years. You know, I need to. We've got some young guys like your Matty Moylans and Josh Mansours and those guys that are coming through. That we'd like you to work with, and yeah, I mean, it was difficult. It was also difficult to go back to Penrith from Hull, where I'd loved it so much, and I bought a house there. You know, I'd really put some roots down in Hull, and leaving was difficult, but it was also. I missed it, you know, and I still miss it now. Like I missed what it felt like to run out at Craven Park. Forget about, you know, 20,000 seat stadiums and, you know, 100,000 seat stadiums. And, you know, I'd played in front of, you know, 90 plus thousand, you know, in the grand final. It's still about the energy of the people within that stadium, of what they can generate. And 12,000 people at KR, at Craven Park, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, you know, there is nothing like it, you know, in my view. And when I went back to Penrith, there was a fair come down where, you know, you'd run out and the atmosphere was just different. And you had to sort of adapt to that. But one of the other reasons why I went to, you know, chose to go to Penrith was the fact that I saw a lot of similarities. Like Penrith were again downtrodden, treated with a level of disrespect and contempt by other areas of Sydney, and I didn't believe in that. You know, I believed in equality. I'm very fiercely protective of fairness and justice, and I don't believe that it's fair. To treat people a certain way purely because of where they live. So that, again, that really resonated me with the people of the West. And again, we made progress at Penrith. No matter what, I mean, progress is critical. Like, as long as you're not going backwards, I think it's important. And then obviously, you know, I went to Newcastle and got to finish my career, like go full circle. And go back on minimum wage and play a role again for, assisting with the development of the younger players like your Lockie Fitzgibbons and, your Safidi brothers and those guys that are currently now playing in first grade and to, to win a premiership there, captaining reserve grade was again, I really consider that, a really moment that I'm proud of.
Yeah, brilliant way to end your career, mate. Obviously, and you've always played for, Wholesome, the people's clubs, aren't you? Which I think you've, you've relished and you've had an outstanding career. And now you're still involved with Rugby League. You talk about equality and you always want to better yourself. You always want to better individuals. And you're now the chief exec, aren't you, for the Rugby League Players Association in Australia. Just tell us a little bit about that. And obviously, you took over, was it Ian Prendergast? And with COVID, you've had probably, a massive role to play, aren't you? And you've done all the protocols. Has it been a busy year for you?
Yeah, it has. I was, again, throughout my career, I saw it as a good, as a great responsibility to try and advocate on behalf of players. And again, I was very pro fairness. And I believe that, given the fact that the significant contribution that players make and the fact that they play in, a hazardous environment, given the fact that we know that, our careers are finite, that I always, had a, bone-deep belief that that players needed to be treated as genuine partners of the game and not simply commodities. So I got involved in, the RLPA in 2012 and was, part of their player leadership team in the collective bargaining agreement for 2013 to 2017. And then once I retired in 2015, at that time I was general president and chair of the RLPA, where I just gradually, progressed through. I then, worked through a process where I, we recruited Ian Prendergast on and then him and I, went through a process where we recruited a new board, new player directors, some new staff, and we sort of tried to, in many ways, build some stronger scaffolding around the RLPA to ensure that it was going to, be durable enough and strong enough to weather some storms that obviously, come when you're in that player representation space. But, effectively, the RLPA is a independent body that is the player representative body that is run, effectively by players for players. And we advocate, protect and support players via negotiating their terms and conditions that are connected to anything from the salary cap to their code of conduct to insurances and various level of protections that we look to secure for them to ensure that we're not just advancing players, we're advancing the game via the representation of players.
Yeah, that's brilliant because it's all about that player security. And I know it's a bit different in Australia. The money's a little bit better, but especially for the guys over in Super League, you've got people who'll never even touch £100,000 a year, whereas you've got football players on £500,000. So I think it's all about the security. And I think, everything you've said there just hits the nail on the head. And I'm sure you've helped a lot of people over your time. And that's ultimately, what you want as a human and a professional for your fellow
rugby league players. I think too often, right? We've been raised, in a way that, where we're told to, to listen to others and follow the path and stay in your seats and be quiet. And, but it's any wonder that, people, always find themselves looking to others for direction and hope and, and you can sort of very much fall in that sort of that victim type, attitude. But, we've got a great opportunity, to step up and players have done right globally, particularly in the last 12 months. And, I'm really excited about the future and working with the NRL on continuing to advance our game and giving it the best possible opportunity to try and reach the heights that, I truly believe that it should be at. It is, in my view, the best team sport in the world, and it's just about, ensuring that we give it the best opportunity to, to expose more people to it. And, And I think the English players have got a great opportunity. And I think that there's a different model over there in England, which I did always struggle with regards to the fact that I don't believe that players collectively are have been brought into the fold like we have done here with the NRL. Because of the fact that at the end of the day, you've got a system over there that doesn't provide a great opportunity to develop, retain, attract the best young talent when you don't have certain things in place that are conducive to high performance environments, and it's not just about pay. It's about just basic minimum standards that you're looking to secure to ensure that you are giving these young men and now women an opportunity to do their best and be rewarded a portionate amount to reflect their contribution. And I don't believe that that's the case in England. But I do believe that we've got it into a position here in Australia where we are, genuinely considered as partners in the game. You can make no mistake here with this, that sports that that respect players and players that have a good, strong and respectful representative body, the code benefits both economically and from a finance and from a development perspective. It benefits and it thrives. We've seen that in US sports. We've seen that in New Zealand sports. We're seeing that in Australian sports. And I just hope that really rugby league, gets its act together in England and provides an opportunity for players to have a strong representative body that is respected, that are able to work together in collaboration with some shared objectives to ensure that that game in England, that has arguably the best fans in the world, get what they deserve. And that is a quality product with quality athletes that are provided the best opportunities to do what they love to do.
Brilliant words, mate. And, we really appreciate everything you did for the English game and the best of luck. We've been the chief exec and the Aussie Rugby League, they're going to absolutely love you. The things that you're doing, what you've just said to us there, it seems like you mean well. And hopefully we can follow. And, thanks for your time, Clint, because it's great to chat to people like you. We've had Dobbo, Scott Morell on. We've got another big guest that we're going to announce soon. It's just been brilliant to talk about them good times and just to have a catch-up, really, because I know myself and obviously Chris, who couldn't join us, and the people of East Hull and the city of Hull, really appreciate everything you did and the best.
No, thanks very much. As I said, my time in Hull was very special. I often think about it, all the time. I have, great memories and, I just think that if it happened, then it was meant to happen, and I'm glad it did when it did, I was meant to make the best of it. And I hope that the people of Hull, both West and East, know just how much or how grateful I am for the experience that they provided me. And it's something that will be with me forever. And I wish all of you, particularly in the North, all the very best.
Yeah, right back at you, mate. We really appreciate it. So that's all we have time for on this heritage episode of the Red Robin podcast with just me, Jock Leard, not Chris Johnson, but definitely our special guest, Clint Newton, who played 99 times for the Robins in 4 seasons, scoring 40 tries.